The Talk of the Northwest, The Greg Hughes Show on Highland Radio.
Hello and a very good morning to you. It's 4 minutes past nine on this Friday, the 24th of July, 2026. And you're very welcome along to the programme. We've got so much coming up on it, as I mentioned. Daniel O'Donnell's on with us a little later on as well. He's got a big event coming up, him and Magella, in the west of the county later this month. So we'll be having a chat to him. That and everything else I mentioned. We want you involved in the conversation, though. Just before I introduce the Friday panel, we want your views as we go on. 086 60 25000 is the WhatsApp and the text number. 086 60 25000. Call us if you prefer on 0749125000 or email comments@highlandradio.com. Let's say good morning to Michael White, Chair of the Green Party in Donegal. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning, Greg.
How are you?
Very well, thanks.
This is good news, good news. Claudia Kennedy is Deputy Chair of Fianna Fáil CDC in Donegal. Good morning, Claudia.
Morning, Greg. It's great to be here.
Great stuff. You're coming through loud and clear, which is great. And Naomi Hamilton O'Donnell, journalist at the Donegal News newspaper. You're very welcome, Naomi. Your first appearance with us here. Thanks so much for accepting the invite.
Good morning, Greg. Thank you very much for inviting me on.
Oh, it's great to have you with us. Right, let's get into it. So whether it's hosepipe bans in a drought, e-scooters on our roads, disposable vapes or social media for under 16s, often a government's response is, the go-to response is an outright ban. The question is, are we turning into a classic nanny state that defaults to prohibition because it's easier than actual policing, education or indeed enforcement? Or has public safety and common sense reached a point where strict bans are the only options left? Michael White, what do you think?
I think there's a mixed bag of things mentioned there. So it ranges from droughts to e-scooters to disposable vapes. And I think overall, the response is kind of proportionate. So at the moment, if you look back, the bans we'd be familiar with would be, say, the ban of smoking in public spaces. Everybody kind of agree with that now. I wouldn't see that being rolled back. Or if you go back a long, long time ago, when seatbelts were first introduced, people moaned and whined. You know, it seems mad now. In the late 70s, people were pretty annoyed about the fact somebody was trying to interfere with how you drive your car. But everybody now accepts that's a good idea. So I think as long as it's proportionate. So if you take each of those cases, like the droughts and the hosepipe ban, a hosepipe ban in Donegal seems a bit nuts at the moment, as the mist gently lands down in their gardens. But I think people would accept it's okay to do it temporarily, as long as longer term steps are taken to make sure the water infrastructure is okay. The e-scooters thing was interesting. So they've agreed not to do a total ban, but you know, you're going to get registered, you're going to have to wear a high-vis jacket and a helmet. I think people would kind of accept that's okay, because there was a guy from the children's hospital or a pediatrician just saying there's something like 30% of brain trauma cases they have with children in the last year have been due to e-scooter accidents. So most people would kind of think
we just introduced them and said, right, they're the same as bikes. Anyone over 16, away you go. You can cycle up any road, bar, dual carriageway. You know, this is reactive only because of the way we introduced it in the first place. So really, you know, like, I don't think there's enough conversation about how we allowed these vehicles onto the road with such little enforcement, so little protection. And now we've got five young people on life support with brain injuries in hospital. Do you know what I mean? Like, that seems to have been ignored in all of this.
Well, it's kind of mad. I don't know if we're different from other European countries, but I mean, it's mad. I live in Greencastle, like, driving through a place called Pigby's Point. You see a kid who's about 14 zipping along at 30, 40 kilometres an hour on the main road. It is an accident waiting to happen. But I think the question is, is it the proposed regulation okay? I think most people would think it's reasonable enough. So the examples given were e-scooters, the hosepipe ban, the disposable vapes, and then the disposable vapes from a Green Party point of view are a bad idea because they throw electronics and plastics and stuff get binned, and we think that's a bad idea. I also think people don't know what the health risks around vapes are. They become widely used, but nobody really knows how dangerous they are. So I don't have any major issues with the vapes, disposable vapes being banned.
It's more the policy about how we find ourselves here, because, you know, there have been court cases and bans in America 10, 12, 13, 14 years ago. yet we allowed onto the market these vapes, 25% nicotine in them, or 25 milligrams of nicotine in them, fruit-flavoured, sexy-looking things, YouTube TikTok videos about how you can blow sexy bubbles or smoke rings with them, and now we're having an all right ban. So it's not the right or wrong of banning individual things. It's just generally how we do things. We let something happen, then we just ban it.
Well, I think they're trying to get their head around how to deal with stuff. Stuff does get introduced much faster now. I mean, again, one of the topics was social media. Social media has been around for quite a long time now. We're only beginning to get our heads together about how to deal with it. So there's the ban in Australia, which kind of doesn't seem to work that well. They're going to ban it in France. There was legislation put through this week. Keir Starmer in the UK being planning to ban it. And they're talking about, I think Simon Harris says he'd like to ban anybody under 16 using social media. That's something I'm not sure about, because I don't know, do the bans work?
I'll come back to you. Naomi, what do you think? Naomi Hamilton O'Donnell.
Yeah, well, I think sometimes, you know, bans can be seen as the easy way out. And I mean, I think if there's a will, there's a way. I mean, in relation to social media, as Michael said, Australia has brought in this social media ban for under 16s. But, you know, these teenagers, if a 12 or 13-year-old has been growing up with access to social media, basically from the time they're probably an infant, they will know their way around these things. And it's very easy to be able to change your age and to get around these things. And I think as well, in relation to e-scooters, I think you can understand where the call for a ban would be coming from, especially from health professionals. And as you alluded to, Greg, you know, the fact that these cause such catastrophic injuries. But I think, you know, there are people who are responsible with these things. You know, myself, when I was driving down Gortley Hill this morning in Letterkenny, I was quite encouraged to see someone come up the road on an e-scooter with their helmet and with their high-vis jacket. But I suppose, unfortunately, a lot of the time you would see people who don't have these things. And especially in cities, I lived myself in Galway for a couple of years, and I used to find if I took one step to the right, I would be feared of being mowed down by an e-scooter because they were on the paths, they were everywhere.
But in fairness to those people, Naomi...
So, you know, there are two sides, yeah.
Yeah, no, what I was going to say to you is, but this is what I don't understand. So when e-scooters were being flagged as coming in, why didn't we have some sort of a training system or an education system? Still to this day, you don't have to wear a helmet on a push bike. You don't have to wear high-vis, and we all know the frustrations out there. So we've gone from really not doing anything to sort of try and educate people how to use these devices on the road and safely, to banning them from it. And we could have a 15-year-old now, right, who could be effectively a full-time carer in education for a mother or father who can't go on Facebook and can't ride an e-scooter because it's the handiest way of dealing with it.
Yeah, I think so. You know, I think it's probably unfair to punish everybody with a ban. You know, I think it's better to look at how these things can be regulated when they are being introduced, as you say, not to just throw e-scooters out on the road, to just, you know, have those policies in place. You know, I think it would definitely help if the Gardaí were able to, had the resources to better regulate these things. But even with the suggestion to bring in a ban for under 18-year-olds using e-scooters on the road, I don't know how easy it would be to be able to tell the difference between an 18-year-old on an e-scooter going up the road and a 16-year-old. And parents are still buying these things for their children. Even though we know the injuries that they can cause. So I think from the outset, if these things are being introduced, that I think we need the regulation for them.
My concern is the damage that's done in advance. So the damage that's done to young people on social media, the damage that has been done for young people, a generation of young people who have a nicotine addiction now. And of course, the lives that were lost and the long-term injuries that have been incurred because we never introduced helmets with e-scooters. And for me, that's the most concerning thing. And the reason I want to have conversations like this, Claudia Kennedy, is for learnings. You know, what can we learn from this? Sometimes you just can't put the genie back in the bottle. We need to do things differently.
I think so. so, Greg. And really, if you look at the government measures and the legislation, it's looking at a regulatory framework for e-scooters. We know they are banned for under 18, but for adults, there's now a regulatory framework where they must wear a helmet, must have a high-vis jacket, they must have tax and insurance. So the government has reacted to this. We do know it was on the table to have an all-right outright ban of e-scooters across the board, but back and had a discussion at that about putting a regulatory framework. And I think it's really important to note as well, there's a big issue with this in relation to enforcement, and we've heard this being discussed all week in the media, we've heard it on waves. Legislature is going to look at certain new laws and legislative provisions for Gardaí in pursuit of e-scooters. We're also using drone technology. And we know this week as well, Minister Jim O'Callaghan made an announcement of the seizure of e-scooters and scramblers in Dublin. That was with drone technology and with the drone unit as well. So the government is reacting to situations. Also, if you look at vaping, we're now bringing in legislation, good, strong legislation, the ban of single-use vapes, which is doing untold damage to young people. Particularly in relation to marketing here, and of course nicotine addiction as well. So the government is reacting to situations, they're looking at education, the stakeholders are all around the table, particularly around the legislation, around racist law and scramblers and complete banned. If you're looking at the stakeholders like the Gardaí, medical professionals that were around the table, particularly around the legislation for education, so they are reacting to. I think that's very, very important.
Okay. Just while I ask this next question, you might just lift your phone a little bit up because it's sitting, the microphone, I think, is sitting on a surface and it just means it's cutting in and out. So I'm not sure if you can just raise the phone a little bit, Claudia. I'm not a know-all, but I know on this programme 7, 8, 9 years ago, and I wish I had the date to dig the tape out, where as someone who smoked heavily for a while and used vapes to get off cigarettes, to see young people, 16, 17 and 18, vaping, having never, ever smoked, and following in America, where at that time, I think it was Juul, the big controversy was happening in Juul, all the signs were there that I just don't think it's an... I think we need to learn from those mistakes. I really worry about so many young people now addicted to nicotine because we didn't look internationally as what was going on, and I just hope we learn from that.
I would agree, and the new legislation as well is very strong in terms of the legislation of opening these shops, and that's where the minister has spoken about working with councils and environmental protection officers, that these pop-up shops have just popped up so quickly all around our villages and towns in Ireland. And one could say, yes, the government has been slow to react to it, but now I think looking at the medical evidence, we know the Irish Heart Foundation has done research on this, Irish Cancer Society, there's international research from the US as well, and we now very strong legislation going through the Oireachtas in relation to the single-use vapes. And it's disgraceful and it's absolutely horrendous to see young people with a nicotine addiction, which is essentially started from vapes. And it's the whole insidious marketing of them, their appearance. But we now look at this very strong, robust legislation coming through the Oireachtas.
Yeah, OK. Just in relation to e-scooters, I think it's under 16s that will be banned from using them and they'll be registered, but there's no confirmation as of yet whether or not tax and insurance. So the raising the minimum legal age to operate these scooters. Sorry, I beg your pardon. You were spot on, Naomi, and indeed, Claudia. They are raising it from 16 to 18. High visibility jackets, vests and helmets. Fines for parents and retailers if they sell them. Now, as I say, just in relation to tax or insurance, we just don't know what the story is there. Michael, I mean, obviously, anything that keeps people out of a car. Sorry, I'm kind of going from a broad picture and then focusing in on some of the bans. But some of the bans, it's really live news at the moment right now. And I think e-scooters, it's whether they're sort of seen as wasps or bees, really. You know, are they an annoyance or are they useful? I don't think any major city or country's figured it out yet.
Yeah, I mean, it provides a really efficient means of transport for lots of people. So in principle, that's a good thing. There's a few things, not just the e-scooter thing, but if you look at the water thing, if, you know, sort of a Green Party view on this. So e-scooters potentially.
You always throw up the quote marks. You are the chair of the Green Party. It's fine. We want to hear your green point of view as well.
Well, it is a point. Almost everything we've discussed has a point. So the vapes are bad because there's loads of crap being thrown into the environment.
Batteries, yeah.
E-scooters are potentially good because they stop people using cars, private cars. And then the hose pipe ban, the issue with that is, like, the projection, 2023 was the hottest year on record, I think. And then 24 and 25. 2026 is projected by this guy called James Hansen to be the hottest year on record. And next year is going to be even hotter. And the point I'm making is that this recent summer stretch we've just had is likely to happen more and more frequently going forward. So you can't have a hosepipe ban every year. And so my point really is, how can a country where it rains so much need a hosepipe ban in July? I suppose everybody asks that.
Yeah, but I mean, if in and around Barcelona and other major cities in Portugal and Spain, they do have water restrictions and bans as well, and they're well accustomed to drier climates than us.
Well, they do, but it doesn't rain 320 days a year in Barcelona. My point is, it rains here all the time. If we had proper infrastructure, we wouldn't need to have a hosepipe ban. So what we really should, it's okay to have a temporary ban, maybe right now, but we should be looking at why.
Yeah, I think so.
It rains nonstop, can't keep a water supply going.
A friend visiting me from Australia this week said this country is just becoming a joke, a hosepipe ban in a country that rains 365 days a year. Thankfully, not quite that much. She's lived in Australia 20 years and never heard of water restrictions. Then don't get started on the roads. Lots of cycle lanes, no cyclists using them, and nothing for emergency services. It would be a joke, only it's so serious. But I did look into these things because I knew these kinds of topics would come up or comments. Water restrictions are quite common in Australia and are regularly enforced during the driest spells, heat waves, or extended droughts. Even when there's no drought, most major Australian cities and states operate under permanent water saving rules. Standard garden hoses left running are illegal. Outdoor watering is banned at certain times of the day. You can't hose driveways, pavements, or footpaths, and you can't clean them generally. That's banned with the dependent on the weather. I know a young person who has stage 4 lung cancer and they vape a lot. We need more awareness on the damage they cause. And I think really, I suppose, the problem from the medical profession is that they will only release what they can actually prove. And we are seeing more evidence because you have to see the long-term usage, don't you? And we're only seeing more evidence now of how dangerous they actually are. Now, an IRPT report this week found 74% of people held in prison on remand, they don't actually get handed a prison sentence at the end of their trial. Most are released because the judge decides time already served on remand was enough. They're given community service or suspended sentence, or indeed might be innocent. If 3 out of 4 people on remand aren't ending up with prison sentences, has the bail system turned into an expensive default holding cell for minor issues, or is strict remand necessary to keep the peace while cases wait months to get to court? I'll start with you, Deputy Chair of Fianna Fáil, CDC. Claudia Kennedy, what do you think?
Well, firstly, it's important to note that Minister Jim O'Callaghan did this report, an assessment of the efficacy of bail laws in Ireland with senior counsel Staines. And within that report, there are 15 recommendations, which I believe his officials and department are looking into. One of the big, and I've picked out sort of the main 6 or 7, one of the key recommendations, having a robust information sharing system between An Gardaí and the court service, introducing an adult bail supervision scheme, to put legislation in place for house arrest, electronic tagging, and that if one is granted bail, with it would be associated positive obligations like counselling, going to addiction services, employment services. It's really important to note that we currently have legislation that passed through the Oireachtas, and it's named the Civil Law Miscellaneous Bill 2026. And it's very important, Greg, because what it states is a judge will now refuse bail for very serious crimes, and it's laid out in that piece of legislation. We know on the 23rd of July, Minister Jim O'Callaghan have announced 267 additional places in Clover Hill Prison. And along with that, there will be 1,500 additional prison places, an extension to Cork Prison, an extension to Wheatfield Prison and a new block extension at the Midlands. And we know there is funding and planning in place as well for a new prison in North Dublin in Thornton. So really this is looking at a legislative piece of work. We're looking at the recommendations. The most one that's been talked about a lot in the media this week is number 10 of the recommendations in relation to the Bail Act of 1997. And what that's saying, one of the recommendations is that if a person has breached the conditions of their bail, then the Gardaí can arrest that person without a warrant. And also, Minister O'Callaghan is looking at community...
Yes, but he's doing a lot of looking. I mean, they looked at sort of, you know, ankle tags and all that kind of stuff. Nothing ever came of it. You know, we are in a situation now where people sort of want solutions and not visions of the future.
I would agree. And that is why this week, 267 places have been announced for Clover Hill Prison. That is why a new piece of legislation is waiting to be signed into law by our president, the Civil Law Bill of 2026. The minister asked for the report. He is now working on putting these, I suppose, recommendations.
So what do you believe the impact of this will be in real terms then?
So in real terms, the thinking is, depending on the seriousness of the crime, that the person would do community sanctions or have electronic tagging or have an adult bail supervision, that they wouldn't necessarily be in a prison and where a prison place...
But this is on remand now, obviously. This is between arrest and a court appearance. How would you do community service between an arrest and a court appearance?
Well, firstly, you're looking at the remand court and I suppose... system with the jail system, and that's why those additional places have been announced for Clover Hill Prison. And it's also about having the correct information in front of the judge as well, and those making those very important decisions. And that's why the sharing of information is very, very important.
Okay, yeah, I'll come back to you in a second, Michael. What's your view?
Well, there's a few things here. First of all, the quote is that 74% of people put on remand end up not going to prison. So that seems something wrong there. And there's a few things about remand. A lot of the reasons people go on remand is because they can't give a fixed address or they can't make bail. So that's them being kind of punished just because they're broke. And address it relates to it. So the answer to this isn't to create more remand places. I think the number of people on remand went from 500 and something 10 years ago to over 1,200 now. So it's increased. So more people are going on remand. And arguably, 74% of them end up not going to prison. They shouldn't be there. Now, not hardened criminals, but it looks like a lot of people are going there. It has a really negative effect. So you might end up on remand simply because you can't provide an address or you can't make bail. But by going on remand, if you had a job, you're likely to lose it. It can break up your relationship. If you've got kids, you may lose access to your kids. So it has a really negative impact. And it seems wrong that 74% of people are not ending up, or, you know.
And to find yourself then in amongst hardened criminals and probably coming out influenced by that and angry at the state.
Yeah, so there's a load of negative impacts. But stepping back a bit further, and I know Claudia didn't have a chance to just address this. The chances of you going to prison are very much related to where you were born, your social economic backgrounds, how much money you make, if you're exposed to childhood trauma or childhood abuse and literacy, also if you're a man. So 95% of prisoners are male. The vast majority of them, like, you can predict who's going to end up in prison. It's not going to be somebody from the leafy Dublin 4 suburbs, typically. It'll be somebody from a tougher city background, generally. If they've suffered childhood abuse of any sort, that's much more likely. If there's any kind of trauma in their childhood, if there's literacy issues. What I'm saying is that it's too predictable. The prison population in Ireland doesn't reflect the general population in Ireland, and it's almost predictable. If you took 100 children into a room now, you could predict with accuracy who's more likely to end up in the court system, and that shouldn't be the case. We're in a republic. We're supposed to cherish all our children equally. So with Shedstep, I think that the issue with people on remand is a big issue, but there's a broader issue here about the overall prison and prison system.
And just in relation to that, Claudia, before I bring Naomi in, you know, looking at some of the headlines from Jim O'Callaghan's bail proposals, they're probably positive in terms of, you know, bail being refused, you know, for sex offenders or alleged sex offenders, domestic violence situations. But just looking through the headlines, it perhaps doesn't necessarily directly address some of the concerns the IPRT had in that, you know, that 74% that really shouldn't be on remand being on remand.
Yes, and if you look at the recommendations in that report, and particularly the civil law bill that's now going to be signed into legislation, there's a big focus on rehabilitation, on supporting the probation service, and also in terms of community sanction, community orders, and also working with the juvenile diversion system that's in place as well. So it's about really looking at how we can prevent people getting further into crime. We're looking at prison overcrowding, looking at capacity issues. So they're also looking at the very serious crimes where no bail will be granted, but then it's depending on the type of crime committed on front of a judge and looking at other sanctions that might be put in place as opposed to being put on remand or being put into a prison, and you would free up those prison places for more serious criminals with very, very serious crimes committed.
Yeah. And it should be pointed out that whilst Jim O'Callaghan said he's looking at it, department officials, or his department officials, are actually now only beginning to look at the feasibility of those 15 measures. Naomi Hamilton O'Donnell, I'm not sure if you do court report within the newspaper, do you?
Well, it wouldn't be me myself.
Yeah, so it's other course. People. Yeah. But you still see the copy and you still get a sense of I just wouldn't want to thrust it on you without double checking, Naomi. I hope you understand. You have sort of an insight there as well, of course, being a one of our best local journalists. But what's your view broadly speaking?
Yeah, well, absolutely. I do see how in very serious cases where remand would be the necessary option. But I suppose this report focuses in on the effect of remand for minor offences. So the report author here, Niamh McCormick, has actually said that this seems to have a disproportionate effect on those suffering from mental illnesses, those who are homeless, suffering from addiction, and and as Michael alluded to, you know, people who are from, you know, different socioeconomic backgrounds. So I think for something like these minor offences, I don't know how beneficial it would be for people who have these sort of issues to be put into an overcrowded prison where there are all kinds of different, you know, serious criminals. I think we do need to look better at rehabilitation, at, you know, preventing crime, you know, preventative measures. And this report says that reducing the number of people on remand in prison would help ease the overcrowding crisis overnight.
I suspect, though, Naomi, we'd need to find the space elsewhere, and I think you've alluded to this. I mean, there's going to be a sizable proportion of these people maybe that have a dependency, an alcohol dependency, a drug dependency, or what have you. And now, I'm not, by the way, suggesting this is across the board, but I'm using maybe a cohort like that as an example, because then you have to create an alternative space for them that might actually help them.
Yeah, well, yeah, this is the thing. You also do have to look at that, look at capacity for helping in these kinds of very specific issues for rehabilitation. And, you know, there is a process to that as well. But I think just really what this report is urging is just that the remand system, it does need a reform and it does need to be assessed. And especially as well, they also recommended an adult-based bail support system, something like what we have with youth as well.
Yeah, okay. We are in the midst of the first hour of this Friday show, which means the Friday panel are with us. Now, yesterday, we had a conversation on Wednesday about traffic in Letterkenny, because we were being told that you can't get into Letterkenny. It's a nightmare to get around. 30% of people don't go in there. It's an absolute disaster. Yes, of course, we know that, right? So randomly then, Caroline came up with the idea. It was me. Let's send some of the team out, start out at one side of Letterkenny, drive through it a couple of times. As it turned out, it probably was one of the quietest days ever for traffic, and they flew around the place. But that being said, you see, what we have to be careful about, Letterkenny, it's not just a town, though. It's an ecosystem, and there's a lot of shops there, and a lot of people are employed, and it's really, really important. So if we achieved anything yesterday morning, say, all right, if it's this time of year, Letterkenny is open for business and you can get in and out of it and around it. And yes, we will return to it in September. But just curious, Naomi Hamilton O'Donnell, I presume you're in and around Letterkenny. You already dropped a hint a little earlier on. Can you understand why people may avoid Letterkenny, or is your feeling on the ground that it's just not quite as bad as you might think?
Yeah, well, absolutely. You know, I can see why there are definitely different times of the day in Letterkenny where, you know, it can be a bottleneck at times. I suppose in the summer months, it is definitely a bit quieter. But I know myself, my commute, even though at the moment it's normally only 10 minutes, but come September, it will be longer and I'll have to leave earlier. And, you know, there are, of course, different projects going on across Letterkenny, the active travel projects and things like that. And but I suppose it is important to, you know, to highlight, like with the girls going out yesterday, you know, that the town, there are times of the day where you can get around, and there are obviously lots of fantastic local businesses around Letterkenny. But I think, you know, traffic, it comes up quite a lot, and especially when I would cover the local council meetings in the Letterkenny Milford Municipal District, I would say traffic is probably, I would imagine, I would guess, the main issue that arises for the Transport Minister to visit Letterkenny to see for himself the different projects that we have, the Northern Network Project, the Southern Network Project. And, you know, it's a point of contention as well. It affects, you know, motorists coming in from all directions into the town. But I suppose it is positive to see that, you know, there are times of the day where it is, you know, eased a little bit. But definitely now when the schools come back and the colleges and whatnot, you know, it will be probably a different story, I would imagine.
See, I'm not from Letterkenny. I'm not, if the truth be told, I'm at the mountaintop here, so I don't really necessarily experience Letterkenny. So I couldn't really tell you with my hand on the heart, when is rush hour? When are the busiest times? And I think, to some extent, there needs to be, and I've said this to the Chamber on a number of occasions, better communication, because we're not all from Letterkenny. So, you know, when is the opportune time to come in? I'm not expecting you to answer that question. Or when is rush hour? You know, so if I come in at 8:30, am I all right? Am I all right at 9:30? What about 9:45? And I think if that messaging was gotten out there, it wouldn't be either it's complete gridlock in the middle of September and it's pretty handy in the summer. Communicate it a bit more. Let us know what's going on, because we're not all from Letterkenny. And I think sometimes when you live in an urban area, you kind of think that that's the only place on earth. Not you, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, no, I think that's understandable. But I think it is the hope of so many businesses, and, you know, so many people commute into the town. And I think sometimes, yeah, before 9 a.m. definitely can be a bottleneck in different parts of the town. But also I've noticed recently around lunchtime as well, kind of between 12:30 to 2 p.m, that can be quite a busy time to try and get around as well. And it's hard to predict sometimes, you know, some evenings and some mornings can be a little bit quieter than others. I suppose it depends maybe as well on people working from home, maybe on different days of the week. But there would be times where I might expect to go into the town and it might be quiet, and then I might get a bit of a shock surprise.
Before we bring our next guests in, your shirt is absolutely lovely, right? But it's triggering my former fruit machine addiction because of the cherries that are off. Michael White, what do you think? We all want the traffic to ease, but we are the traffic. I think some people don't realise that if you're sitting in the traffic, you're the traffic, right? You're not caught up in it, you're it. But you're always going to get congestion in a big urban area, aren't you?
It seems to have got worse. So I'm coming in from the dairy side. We have an office in Colab in ATU. And so I can tell you when the rush hours are, because you can see the cars ranked up on that road. It appears to me to have got worse since the new traffic light system went in with the dual carriageway. So Derry had a similar problem about 15 years ago, because I used to work there, and they sorted it out through changes in the traffic light system. But one thing I'd say, though, that the solutions to everything are traffic and car oriented for Letterkenny, and being in the Green Party, I suggest they should also look at a greater emphasis on public transport. So everybody around the county relies on Letterkenny for this, the hospital and ATU, and there's also big employers there. So lots of people from around the county, it's a focus. So it's important, not just for Letterkenny's inhabitants, but also for the rest of the county, that the traffic improves. some of that should be public transport. So local link straight, you can get a local link bus from where I live in Greencastle to Letterkenny and back, and the service is great. In Letterkenny itself, though, if I left the front of ATU to go to a shop, to get from there to, say, to Dun Stores, you have to do this huge... It's designed for cars. It's not designed
for
humans.
And the thing that's interesting, Michael, is that, you know, there is this pent-up demand for public transport in Letterkenny. Like, lots and lots of people are working for this, you know, three-vehicle town bus, not working, waiting for it. So normally you say, right, well, if we introduce it, hopefully people will start using it. The way it is now there's that pent-up demand for it. So whenever that finally gets over the line, I think it was November 26th, and unless Naomi can correct me, I don't think we actually have a date yet as to when it will come in. So, you know, this is one of those situations, what you're proposing, people are waiting for and can't wait to get on it, Michael.
But even without, say, talking about buses and stuff, just I'm talking about walking in a straight line across Letterkenny.
Yeah, right, I get you, yeah.
You know, it was designed as if it's some American suburb. The more recent, you know, I'm talking about the ring road that goes around where Aldi is and connection into where...
Understood, yeah.
There's a lot of Letterkennys like that, and it could be straight out. Access to the hospital for everybody should be easier not having to use your car to get to the hospital. And there should be facilitation for people with disabilities or limited mobility. So it shouldn't just be, let's have bigger roads and more cars coming through or around Letterkenny. There should be other aspects to the plan for it.
Mm. Okay. Claudia, I don't know how often you're in and out of Letterkenny. Maybe you're like me and not quite as often as maybe Michael and Naomi. But what's your view?
Well, I'm actually in Letterkenny quite often. My partner works in Letterkenny, so we're there. He's there daily. What I would say again is the timings. It depends when you're in Letterkenny. Like, for example, on a Friday evening, when I go into Letterkenny, I know I'm going to be stuck in traffic for quite a long time, and I'm prepared for that. The same in the mornings, you have to go extra early in terms of avoiding traffic. And sometimes people take back roads if they can to avoid traffic congestion as well by Old Duns. But what I would say is it's testament to the investment that's in Letterkenny in terms of the booming economy. I would say to our increase in population. Unfortunately, we see this in most urban centres where we have good employment, we have lots of multinational companies in Letterkenny, and the infrastructure could improve. And we know the government has been committed to the 10T.
Just in relation to that, Claudia, and I don't want to be argumentative because it's not the nature of this, but I mean, like, at this, I don't want people to be peed off listening as well. You know, the reality is we should be planning for the growth in town. 10T shouldn't be in the planning stage. It should be completed. If we are designing roads and implementing changes, they should be able to accommodate traffic. They should be able to accommodate emergency vehicles. You know what I mean? We have to make sure in terms of active travel, we aren't putting the cart before the horse. You know, like, people's... I've been waiting a long time for the 10T, generations and generations and generations. And, you know, we're not seeing any planning for Letterkenny, and it can be quite frustrating. And I know you're kind of doing the party line thing, Claudia, but I do have to challenge you a little bit on that, because the situation is being worsened at the moment. It's not being improved. It's actually being worsened as people wait for the 10T.
Just to say, there has been government commitment with funding, and we know there's legislation needed, and there has been planning objections to the 10T as well. But also, if you look at the provisions that have been put in place, for example, we talk about active travel, we talk about the local link, public transport, we have seen investment on your way into Letterkenny. So the investment is there. Absolutely. Everybody would agree, from a common sense point of view, Greg, there has to be future planning, obviously. That goes without saying. But there have been commitments to the 10T project, particularly from the Irish government in terms of funding and planning legislation. That's not the government's fault if somebody objects to it. And our councillors, and particularly our Donegal County councillors, cross-party, have done huge amounts of work in terms of lobbying our Minister for Transport. And that's cross-party, Greg, as well. It's not just a oil thing. Everybody has an investment and a want for a healthy, clean environment and a transport system that is workable for everyone.
A caller says, I would love to see Donna Marie Doherty undertake the Letterkenny route again at 5 p.m. to see what traffic is like with schools off. I don't think it's a true reflection. But you have to understand that in our conversation on Wednesday, potentially the damage could have been done to Letterkenny right now, because people were being told that you can't get in at any stage, really, and it's really bad at certain times and you can't get around it. And, you know, we've a responsibility to you can't not go to Letterkenny in the summer because it's busy in September. So it was random, and it's just the way it was at that time. Going out at 9 yesterday morning was a joke. Go out at 1 or 2 in the afternoon. It took me an hour and 10 minutes to collect my granddaughter yesterday afternoon. What you did yesterday was a joke. Nobody bees up at that time of the morning. All right, okay. Well, anyway. Now, new figures out this week show almost two-thirds of people in Ireland are now cutting back and eating out, with many skipping courses or hunting for early bird deals just to afford a meal, with the 9% VAT cut for hospitality having just kicked in this month. Is it, and it's really, that's actually to make it more manageable for businesses to be in business. It's very unlikely to be passed on to customers. So the question is eating out simply becoming unaffordable luxury for ordinary houses, or are restaurants doing all they can to stay alive against soaring overheads? It's a tricky one, Naomi. I'll start with you, Naomi Hamilton O'Donnell. I think we are at the point now, and it's, I don't know, as I said in the show yesterday, I don't know if it's 10 or 12 or 13 euro starters, or it's 19, 20, 21, 22, if you don't have a steak, main courses. But we're not going out as much as we used to. And obviously other people aren't either. What do you think of the situation, Naomi?
Yeah, I definitely do see a bit of a shift towards eating. Maybe if people are going for a meal out, you know, they might go earlier in the day. And, you know, there's so many different cafes around. But I think, you know, the idea of a three-course meal might be, you know, more kept for something like a wedding or a very special occasion. I do think that people are really trying to get value for money, especially with the cost of living crisis. I think if people are deciding to eat out for dinner, I think, you know, people would like to think that they're getting their value, and especially when a main course is easily, you know, 20 euro plus on its own, and that doesn't even take into account, you know, drinks, wine, cocktails, anything like that.
I'd like to go out with you, Naomi. Drinks, wine and cocktails. Yeah.
Well, we're talking about special occasions.
Of
here,
course,
Greg.
All right, yeah. Okay. Yeah, I get you. Yeah, but yeah. People are having to think twice. Michael, what do you think?
Well, it's funny, I was just talking to ChatGPT about this earlier to figure out. So they're saying that the overall restaurant takeaway business has actually grown 4% per year over the last 5 years, and it's worth 10 billion. And there's like 2 billion that's takeaway. So I think people are just beginning to order at home. They're saying that the average Irish consumer orders 2.9 times per month, and the average order value is 46 euro. So I feel I'm being left behind. I don't do this. So
no, me neither.
Apparently we're a real outlier. They're saying it's being driven by, first of all, big chains like Wendy's and stuff moving into Ireland, but also the platforms like Just Eats. So they're getting super efficient. And Ireland, unusually, the number of people who can get their meal within 30 minutes or less.
So are you saying that maybe if you look at the raw stats about people cutting back on eating out, they're not necessarily cooking at home, they're eating in potentially, and that could be a factor?
They're there with your bag of cans on the couch and your pizza. Something like that.
Hey, I like your nights out too. It's not just the only, let's have a bag of cans and a pizza.
My weekend or my business, Greg. No, but I mean, it looks like there's generally been an increase in the overall business. 5% per year, and it's huge. I mean, it's 10 billion, that's restaurants and takeaway, but 2 billion of that's just takeaway. So it's maybe people are eating at home more often than they used to.
Yeah, what do you think, Claude? Yeah, I mean, I think unless you're really well off, you know, we do have to now, if you were lucky enough to eat out at all, people are sort of, I think, checking themselves potentially, because, you know, you don't get a bill for 120 quid, like, you know, for two people or something like that if you decide to have a steak.
Absolutely, and we do the same here. We shop around, we look for the best value. Again, it's a luxury to eat out. And I think one of the things that we need to remember about the 9% VAT cut is that it's about keeping the doors open to our cafes and our businesses and maintaining employment. This sector employs over 150,000 people, and particularly here in Donegal, we're so reliant on tourism. And so it's a really important sector for us in terms of employment. And those cafes and restaurants, they're the heartbeat of a lot of rural communities in our towns and villages. And we all probably have family members, our friends, our relations employed within that sector as well. So it's not being necessarily passed on to the customer, but what it is doing is keeping towns alive, and it's supporting those businesses in really difficult, harsh economic circumstances, and that's due to global constraints as well. But absolutely, I think, Greg, everybody is feeling the pinch with the cost of living crisis and are being that bit more prudent and shopping around and checking. And as Naomi has said, I would agree, it is very much you might just go out for one course of a meal. Going out now for three courses seems to be unheard of. So it's really about supporting local businesses and keeping the doors open in rural communities to these vital places of employment.
Yeah, I would like if they reduced the sizes of, you know, so you could have a taster as a starter and a taster as a dessert. So the main course obviously would be it. So have some sort of a much cheaper version. So you can sort of, you know, have a bit of a taste of it. But rather than have half a loaf, then no bread at all is what I'm suggesting. But anyway, it's a tough old time for them out there. And I'd also hope we don't get to a situation where sometimes eating in a takeaway is more expensive than a restaurant. OK, Claudia, thank you for joining us. Have a wonderful weekend.
Thank you, Greg.
Bye-bye. Look after yourself. Good to have you on again. Michael White, look after yourself. Thanks so much for your time, as always.
Thanks, Greg. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Really. Naomi Hamilton-O'Donnell, journalist at the Donegal newspaper. Will you be back? No, you're muted now, just when you're about to tell me to go and do one. Will you come back with us again?
No, I'm back, yeah, and I will be back, yeah.
Oh, lovely stuff. Thanks so much.
I certainly would, yeah, and thank you very much, Greg.
No, you did well. Thank you so much. Look after yourself. You can read Naomi Hamilton, O'Donnell, journalist at the Donegal News, in the newspaper and online as well. Right. Now, I just want to give a quick mention, if that's okay, to an event that's upcoming. It's the James Russell Memorial Tractor Run. The James Russell Memorial Tractor Run. The presentation night is tonight in the Clannery Hotel from 9 till 12. As you may know, they did a vintage tractor run from Ballyhigue in County Kerry, definitely in County Kerry, to Churchill in Donegal. This was just around about the time Kerry and Donegal were playing in the All-Ireland series. They did that from the 21st to the 24th of May and raised a total of, listen to this, €61,000. And that's going to be split between the Donegal Hospice and the Kerry Hospice. Tammy Meehan is singing tonight. Presentation of checks around 10 p.m. No door charge. Everyone's welcome. Fair play to Ruth and Terence McClintock for getting in touch with that. Greg, there's a wee black and white cat lying dead on the road in Dunmore in Carrigans, just in case some family are looking for the wee soul. And I'm sorry if that's how you've heard the information. I just don't know how else I would transmit it to you. But unfortunately, a wee black and white cat lying deceased on the road at Dunmore in Carrigans. Thanks again to Michael White, Claudia Kennedy, Naomi Hamilton-O'Donnell, our Friday panel. Not many people can afford to eat out in Donegal these days. Letterkenny is to Donegal what Dublin is to Ireland, which is not a good thing. But listen, whenever you get population centres and all that type of stuff, you know. My only concern is we are relying too much on multinational companies and putting our eggs in the one basket. We should focus on our own companies and growing them. There's a lot of medium, small-sized companies as well that are doing well, it has to be said. Right, every single Friday morning at 11 o'clock, we release a podcast. It's a sister podcast to this show. It's called The Greg Hughes Podcast. Now, thank you so much to all of you who don't just listen to sporadic episodes, but have subscribed to it and listen every week. And it means that we are actually, and it's fantastic to see, doing really well locally. But the podcast features really regularly very high up in the streaming charts nationally, which is fantastic, isn't it? And we've got different guests from all different backgrounds. And this week's guest is Mary Coughlan. I'll tell you more about the podcast. I just want to tell you where you can listen to it. Of course, the Highland Radio website, it's released there at 11 o'clock. But maybe you prefer to listen to it on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Wherever you listen to podcasts, search The Greg Hughes Podcast and you will find it. Also, from this week going forward, you can watch it. So just search The Greg Hughes Podcast on YouTube as well. So you can't afford to miss it. No, that's somebody else's. You will see it wherever you look for your podcasts, preferably here on highlandradio.com, of course. So this week, I'm joined by former Taoiseach and current Donegal GEA chairperson, Mary Coughlan. It's a wide-ranging chat about her life in and out of office, but we start right back at the beginning in this clip I'm going to play for you. Mary talks openly about how family tragedy shaped her life, especially how the passing of her uncle Clem and then the sudden death of her father Cahill just a few years later unexpectedly thrust her into the world of politics at just 21 years of age. Here, have a listen.
Well, first of all, Clement was killed in an accident, which was just awful. Absolutely awful. He was 40 years of age. Peggy was left with seven small children, some of them teenagers, and the youngest was very young. In those days, the support for TDs was very little, only for the ANTO, to be fair. They would have struggled even more. So that was a desperate tragedy that Clement was killed. There was political nuances as well, but from a family point of view, it was awful.
And you have to, I suppose, balance the two.
You have to balance the two. And then that was a time of political upheaval. It's been well documented about the heave against Charlie. There was a Senate election, et cetera, et cetera. Then there was a lot of pressure put on my father to go forward for election. A lot of it came from our local commons. And he was hesitant because he loved teaching and he liked farming. And he liked to be in Donegal. And it was a huge change to have to move to Dublin. But he relented. So I would say he was a reluctant politician in the beginning.
What do you think tipped him over the edge in accepting it? Was it a legacy thing? You know,
bit of that. Oh. And the fact that Clement had only had 3 years.
Yeah.
And Clement had three elections in 3 years. And I suppose he got a lot of support from the locality, from our local people that wanted him to go. And he went into the county council and went into the Dáil. And he was only starting to enjoy what he was doing when, unfortunately, he got sick. So he found that a huge change. And I suppose he didn't believe in his own capacity, where in fact he was more than able to do the job. And he, you know, was very driven that he was there to support the people that elected him, and that was his calling. And you know, in our house, and I was in boarding school, but you know, you get up in the morning and everybody's getting ready for school, and there'd be 10 or 11 standing at the kitchen table because daddy would be going to the council. Those days, people didn't travel as much. They would be helping them with their tax or with an SI house or what, planning or whatever it was. So it was a different era. So we were accustomed to people just walking in and out our house. So we're very familiar with that. But it was a big difference.
Yeah, and I think it's important that you point out the slight difference there is now. I know your phone's never off as a councillor now, and I know there's great pressure on TDs, but it was far more sort of integrated into the community back then, wasn't it?
Was.
And that was an expectation.
And
as
people
well.
Drove to the office to see Kathleen or whoever, Marie or whoever it was, Breach, in the office. People went to the office. And then the TDs went out and did clinics so that you could meet your TD in different places. You did it used to be in the paper.
Funny, I was speaking to Denny McGinley not so long ago on this podcast, and he talked of that as well, how different it was.
It was totally different. Plus the fact that people waited for an answer.
Yeah.
You wrote a letter or you made a phone call. And the pace of life was different. Very different. And there was great camaraderieship between, say, the people who worked in the county council and their elected representatives, and everybody was trying to do their best. So you went to a county council meeting on Monday, you went round all the offices, you met all the staff, you took the messages, you took back the answers. You know, that was the way it was done. Now people send an email and they expect an instant response.
But also too, and this is not a criticism because I'm probably as guilty of it, we believe we have so much knowledge that it's very rare we'd be satisfied with a response.
Well, unless it's going your way.
Yeah, you know what I mean? So
unless it's going your way. But like, there was great friendships and things like that as well. But definitely when you look at the way politics has changed, it has been immeasurable.
Before we talk about your dad's sudden and sad passing and your enter into politics, you know, I mean, like, you come across as a very tough person, I think, to people. No, not tough in a bad way. I'm on about resilient and, you know, and we'll get through to the first that you you've achieved as a politician. But as a, especially in a family of seven, right, where was your place?
Oh, I was the boss.
You were the boss, right, okay, so it's all starting to fall into place.
I was the oldest and I went to boarding school.
Yeah.
John was next. He went to boarding school in Falcarra for a while. The reason we went to boarding school was that some of the leaving certificate subjects weren't available in the Abbey Vocational School
right.
at the time.
That was the local school, obviously, the local, to you, yeah.
And then it grew and developed massively. I think you went there yourself.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So then the rest, everybody else went to the Abbey Vocational School.
And so in terms of so would you have been in consultation with your parents going, this is perhaps what I want to do or where I want to educate myself, and then you decided as a... Or were your parents the type that would say, you know, if you want to achieve the best you can achieve, these are the types of courses, and then you can decide what you want
no,
to do?
No, education in our house was absolutely paramount.
Yeah.
We sat around the kitchen table. We still have that kitchen table, right. by the way. It was a memory we kept when Mammy died. And regardless of your age, you sat around that kitchen table.
Yeah.
Daddy would be doing the correcting, and you would have a wee mark in your own book to see when it was coming to your turn. So you were either going to kind of excuse yourself for 5 minutes in case you something would happen. But my father was the master. He was always the master. Mm. He never differentiated with any of us at school. And even if you weren't at school, you sat at the table and you did your drawing or your spelling or your reading or whatever. So education was hugely, hugely important in our house. So the view was that to the best of your ability, you made your choices.
Did we get to see your granddad with grandchildren, or did he not live for that? It would have been interesting to see if the master's hat slipped. Because you see that so often now, don't you?
Clement was a master as well.
Right.
Auntie Tina was a school teacher. My Aunt Mary was a school teacher. And I think Paul Coughlin's the only one who became a school teacher. So it didn't move into the next generation.
Yeah, but I've seen, you know, when I see it in other families with my mum and dad, like, and you see them with their grandchildren, or you did before they passed. And I was, you'd be like, oh, where were these people when I was that age?
I know.
There's
just
something, I think it's with maturity and all that type of stuff. Losing your dad at such a young age, I mean, as an adult now, you can reflect on perhaps what could have been in terms of his career and what he could have achieved and the influences he could have made. But at that time, it's a personal loss. And he sounds like he was very much held in high regard. Mm-hmm. You'd already had a recent tragic loss. And here we go again. Mm-hmm. It must have been incredibly tough.
It was very tough, and I would say it was probably tougher on the younger ones in our house, because there were still younger kids, and I was doing my finals at the time, so I was in university, John was in university, so we were that much older and we had much more time.
Yes, indeed. I enjoyed my conversation with Mary Coughlin, and from there she continues into how she got into politics herself and her early years and all what the Dáil was like then. The tricky times for all of us, but also, of course, as her as an individual, when she became Tánaiste, the biggest job, perhaps at the worst time, because that was around about the time of the crash, what it feels like to lose your seat. What do you do next? And how do you end up becoming the head of the GEA in Donegal and the challenges that you have to deal with there? It's over an hour long. I hope you'll enjoy the chat. It's available for you to listen on our website or wherever you get your podcasts from 11 a.m. You can watch it on YouTube as well. Just search the Greg Hughes Podcast. We're joined on the programme now by the one and only Mr. Daniel O'Donnell. Do you need me to talk a little bit whilst you wash that down, Daniel, or are you good to talk?
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
You've had your breakfast handed to you, have you?
Well, no, I'm just having a cup here.
Lovely stuff. Right, we're speaking ahead of a tea party that you and your beautiful wife are hosting. Before I get to that, is this one of your favourite sort of spells of the year, Daniel? It's so busy in and around the place that you love so much and spend so much time promoting.
There's great atmosphere at home. I was last night, we were over in the port. The new Indians were there. The port has had a great week. Great week weather-wise, and a great week. They're celebrating their 50th anniversary of the Burtonport Festival, and a great week was had by all. And then Dunlow starts tomorrow evening, and we're looking forward to another great week there. So, yeah, it's just a great time, a lovely time to be at home, there's no doubt.
You look great. You always do, but there seems to be a particular sparkle. Is there slightly less of a schedule working in your favour?
Oh, there's a lot less, definitely. Bar the few things I'm doing now, you know, over the next couple of weeks. And of course, Gertrude Burns Cruise, I'm doing that in September. And we did Opry and Derry, the Opry shows for TG Cahir. We did them the end of June, beginning of July. But for the most part, I've had a very relaxing time, which I've enjoyed and am enjoying very much. And we intend, or I intend to, you know, carry that out until next year. I'll do the same things next year, Please God, Opry and the festivals. And then back, the first shows proper back are Killarney in September 27. So it's a long time to be looking ahead. But listen, this next week is what's important now. And hopefully the weather, I know the weather has been great. The forecast is not too hectic. So I think there might be umbrellas needed for Tuesday.
We don't know. I don't know because, you know, it is still the summer. Right, Daniel and Magella's Tea Party for Relay for Life, Boil the Kettle Appeal takes place, as Daniel's just hinted at there, on Tuesday the 20th of July at their home in Mean Banna, Dunlow. It's from 1pm to 4pm. And the excitement around this event, Daniel, is already there. And you're encouraging everyone who can go along to go along, but there's no doubt the numbers are going to be huge, and it's all for Relay for Life.
Well, it's a great cause. I mean, we used to have, of course, the open days for many years, and the last one was in 2000, and that was always down, you know, where I was brought up at my mother's house. And then we decided that just there was too many people coming. And it was, you kind of outgrew what it was meant to be. But when this idea came up because of the relay having April as the Boil the Kettle month, a few local people came up to us here and asked, would we attend one of the events in the hall? And when we talked about it, we thought, sure, if we're going to have it that close to home, why not wait and have it during the festival like we used to? So it's 26 years since we had this.
My word. That is, people are going to hear that and go, what, 26 years? Because there's people listening will have been had attended. So the reality is that this is a private dwelling and it doesn't have a 700 space car park outside. So there's a lot of planning going into this to ensure that as many people are accommodated as comfortably as possible in terms of park and ride and such.
Well, it seems like that they're very on top of everything now. We are very grateful to all the people taking charge of this, you know. So the park down football, Cadger Rovers football field, they're going to park cars down there. Now, if there are people that have difficulty in any way, you know, mobility difficulties, they will be allowed to be driven up in the car that they're in, or the transport they're in, dropped off, and then whoever's driving will drive that car back and park it, and they'll be brought up, you know, in the bus or whatever mode of transport is there to bring people up. But for the most part, they'll be directed to a park, you know, a car parking place, and then bussed up to the house. So we might get a shock. There might be nobody for the bus at all.
I don't think. That would be a shock. That would be a shock. But the reality is there's going to be a huge crowd, not just locals, but people coming to the area as well. And just for people to have a realistic expectation that from previous events, and we're going back over a quarter of a century, people may have to queue, but they'll get in. You can't reserve your spot. But enjoy it. I think it's going to be a lovely atmosphere, even if you're queuing.
Yeah, I think if people bring, you know, there's nearly everybody in their house has a wee fold-up chair. If you bring that with you, and if you think you need the umbrella, sure, bring it too. It's all happening outside the house. Obviously, you know, there's no house big enough, hopefully, to hold the amount of people that might be there. So we can't take some in and leave some out. But we're looking forward to it. I mean, Relay for Life is something that's been very, very important in the county. And, you know, we have been honoured, Jill and myself, to be the patrons of it for the past number of years. And I have been involved since the very first one and missed very few, you know, when I was touring. There was a couple of times I couldn't be there. But it's a great event. And unfortunately, there are very few families and houses that haven't been, you know, affected by cancer. So all of this is very important to, you know, to raise money for. And, you know, as well as that and the festival on Sunday, the country concert is on from 3 to 6. And that'll be another great day. I have to put on the glasses now. Brendan Shine, I don't know if Brendan has been up this way for the festival in a long time. Brendan and Emily are there, and Grant Gaffigan and Conor O'Donnell and Clodagh Lawler, Barry Kerwin and Fergal Flaherty and myself. And it'll be the comp or Gavin Boyle. So that's from 3 to 6 this Sunday. And then on the first Monday in August, which is, I'll be doing the Crown and Cabaret too for the festival. But on the first Monday in August, Dunluce has their big day at Rorty's there. And Margaret will be there for that. And John and Diane Cannon, Clan McRury, and Conor O'Donnell and Shuni Cramsey and myself. And the money from that day goes to the hospice, Donegal Hospice, the Cancer Flights, and the Kevin Bell Repatriation Fund. So all of these things, I know it's a lot to be asking people to attend, but we're blessed, I suppose, that we're well. And unfortunately, everything that money is raised for, there are people that need to avail of these services at some time. So hopefully people will be able to come to everything, or some of the things anyway.
Well, you see, you're giving something. So, you know, everyone's getting something for their generosity too. And I think what you have and Magella have done too is the fantastic work in raising money for Relay for Life. But beyond that, and it's almost as important, is A, talking about the services that are there and the supports that are there, talking about the stories of people coming through their cancer journeys, respectfully remembering those that haven't, but also normalising a conversation, which is about one of the most serious things, and that is invaluable as well. I looked at the weather. It's going to be lovely and mild, right? 18 degrees. It's not guaranteed to rain either. And the beautiful light southwest wind. Can you imagine a beautiful light southwest wind in Mean Bannet? Where else would you be?
You are just fantastic.
Okay.
You'd sell snow to the Eskimos.
Oh, no, I would. And coal to the new people in Newcastle.
Well, listen, you know, the thing about it is, as Magella to say, when we're at Relay, we were blessed this year with a great day. But, you know, when she was gone through the cancer and having the treatment, the chemotherapy, what she would give to go out for a walk on a wet day at the time, and she couldn't lift her head off the pillow. So I suppose that's what you think about on days like this, when you're thinking, oh, should I bother? It's not a great day. Just, you know, it's easy for us to... It's not. Please God, it won't be a bad day.
No, you're talking it down and I'm talking it up, but I love what you're saying. Let's celebrate our good health.
Yeah.
You know, because often, it's a really, really
interesting. There'll be loads of stuff baked and everything. There's people baking and people ringing to see can they bring bacon. So we couldn't eat everything after this is all over. So please come and eat.
And if you can't make it, but you want to support Daniel and Magella, you can go to relayforlife.ie/event/donate/Donegal/donate. But we'll link that.
Yeah. It's donations on the day, you know. There's not a price for this. It's just whatever people want to donate to them. I think Relay for Life have mugs, kind of, what do they call it, that? Commemorative mugs.
Yeah, it is.
Didn't I get that out well?
Are you going to have pictures on them, like Charles and Diana? It's going to be like Daniel and Magella.
I don't know. You know, there is a picture. I've seen it now, and I can't exactly tell you what it is, or I saw it, should I say. Magella's always correcting me, saying, I do say, I've seen that. I should have said, I saw it.
Don't change now, Daniel. Don't change now. Come here. Listen, lovely to see you. Enjoy the week. And Tuesday the 28th of July, it's Daniel and Magella's Tea Party for Relay for Life, Boil the Kettle Appeal. There's park and ride. If people need to be accommodated at the front door, they can be dropped off and the car goes away there. But the reality is that it's to get everything moving. And, you know, you're going to have fun. I can hear sing songs in the line already, Daniel. I can see you. I can just see it. So I think it's going to be a wonderful celebration. Thank you so much, as always, for joining us.
Thanks a million.
Bye-bye. We'll see you soon. Bye-bye. Okay. Bye. Daniel O'Donnell there. Now, all eyes are on Dunloe, of course, because there's that big event on Tuesday. Actually, we are on Monday coming from Cancer Care West in Letterkenny, which is another fantastic, fantastic organisation in that realm, of course. Then on Tuesday, we have the annual tradition of the Marys from who will be partaking in the Mary from Dunloe crowning event. They're going to come into studio. We love that. They're coming in between 10 and 11, so we're moving Garda slot into the first hour. And then what else? On Friday, we're broadcasting live from Dunloe, from Sweeney's down there in Dunloe as well. So it's all go next week. Very exciting. Okay, Brendan Devaney is going to be joining us. Hopefully, if we can squeeze it in before 11 to see who he's picking for the All-Ireland final, which we'll all be watching on Sunday. But first, we're talking about the Ronald McDonald House Golf Classic, sponsored by iMotors. It's at the beautiful Dunfanaghy Golf Club and takes place on Friday the 14th of August. Victor Byrne is manager at McDonald's Letterkenny and is the organiser of the Ronald McDonald House Golf Classic. Good morning to you, Victor. Good to see you back.
Morning, Greg, and thanks for having us back again.
It's a pleasure. We also have Sean Quinn, CEO of Highland Radio, former captain at Dunfanaghy, and kind of integrated into the whole blooming thing.
I actually forgot I was captain at Dunfanaghy. Yeah, is that?
Well, I'd remind you.
Thank you very much for that, Greg. Yeah, it's great to be here.
We're going to be speaking to Claire Lawler Lynch very shortly as well. But Victor, this is I think we know more now about McDonald's involvement in this house, but just give us the background and why events like these and support for them are so important.
I suppose you probably better talk to Claire first, because I think when you hear somebody that's actually been used the house and what it's for, that goes against it, you know. Mm. We're there in the background, McDonald's. They support the Ronald McDonald charity all the time, no problem. From all the franchisees around Ireland to different events that happened, you know. And as I said last year, I want to thank Sean, yourselves, the Highland Radio, and iMotors. We have an annual golf classic every year in Dublin and go up to that and that. And I've always said that I would love to see if we could do one up here in Donegal. And we did that last year. It was a success, thanks to yourselves coming down and making it a great day. Like, you know, we brought in over $8,000 that day, which just was phenomenal. Like, to get
where is the house and who avails of it?
Well, as I said, there's a house at the minute, you know, on Crumlin Hospital. Yeah. And it's there, and different families, like, and I think just nearly over 400 from Donegal alone have used it, you know.
So when people have the unfortunate situation of a young person in their life that requires often sort of a prolonged stay at Crumlin, this house is there, and you can book a stay there, and it means that the family or some of the family are close by.
Yeah. It's basically, I suppose the best way to call it, it's a home away from home. Mm. Now, Claire will tell you all about it because she's had first-hand experience.
Claire Lawler Lynch, mother of Oscar, good morning to you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, Greg. Thanks for having me.
No, it's good to have you with us. Claire, what has your experience been of the McDonald House?
Greg, I can't even, like, speak of it highly enough. We had Oscar, and from he was born, he went straight to Crumlin when he was just, you know, not even an hour old, I'd say. And we were there and we stayed in the Ronald McDonald House 397 nights. So that's just over a year. And just being able to be close by to Oscar was just so invaluable at the time.
Yeah, it's great, obviously, that you are there to support Oscar. But I can imagine for you, it would have been very, very difficult if you had to travel, you know, even an hour out the road. You would feel that sense of removal from him and not being there if and when he needed you. So, as I say, it's wonderful for Oscar, but I think for families and for mums like yourself, it's invaluable to have that close contact.
Well, do you know, Greg, it's not even just about location. Like, yes, I mean, we live about 3 hours away from the house. From Crumlin Hospital in the Ronald McDonald House. We also have a son, Arthur, who at the time was like just turned 4, and he is able to come up and stay with us and see his brother. At the time, as a family, we had to decide to split, you know, once Oscar was out of immediate danger. He I stayed up for the first kind of 6 to 8 months with Joe and Arthur coming down every weekend. And then vice versa, when I went back to work, Joe stayed up with Oscar and me and Arthur came down every weekend. But it's such a support network. It's not just bricks. It's a complete package of a support network when you just feel absolutely vulnerable and out of your depth, you know?
Yeah, okay. And it's the kind of service, and this is what I was told of trying to get through this morning, you don't necessarily know it's there until you need it. And that's why it's important, sort of, we know exactly what's there and why it's important to support it. Because I'm sure when you come out of it, Claire, you'd move heaven and earth to support it because you know how invaluable it has been on Oscar and your family's journey.
Honestly, if the guys at the house ask me to do anything for them, I'm there. Like, that's such a great point, Greg. And I've made it time and time again through various things. You really don't know about it until you need it. And then you just think, how does everyone not know about this? You know, and not just me and our family directly, but like, you know, now where we live, like we've had a lot of support and I had people reach out when unfortunately their child was sick. They were like, oh, can you tell me a bit more about that? And I was able to like point them in that direction. But just like I said, like there's loads of volunteers and the people that work there and that's what the house is. It's not just the bricks and being close by. You know, there's volunteers that cook food and, you know, when you're not even thinking about eating. And then there's like little activities, like someone comes in to like cut your hair when you're not even thinking about those things. But you need to, you know, there's people that maybe use it for a short amount of time. But for people like our family, we were there for over a year. Like I've never lived anywhere like that for a year, you know, and it just, I just can't even convey like how much that house means to me and the people that are in it.
How's Oscar now, Claire?
Oscar's doing well, thanks, Greg. He's turning 2 in October and he's really come on a lot since being home. We're actually up next week just for appointments and I'm really looking forward to popping into the house and seeing everybody. And so thanks. He's doing much better.
Lovely. Send our love. We'll give him our love. Thank you
so
much.
I will, of course.
Fair play to you, Claire. Best of luck with everything. Claire Lawler Lynch there, mother of Oscar. Don Fanahy's role in this, Sean, i.e. what are you doing in here?
Yeah, well, I meant to ask you, will you be in my team, Greg?
Well, you see, I want to just have a very brief conversation about how, firstly, we need to, we did play during the week. I think it was kind of like a test. My focus is keeping my mind in the game, especially when younger players are messing about, right? So you've got that maturity to stay in the game.
Yeah.
I need to do that, right? Well, so I'm going to do much better.
Let's be honest now. If it was going to go on your first 4 holes, you're in.
Six, yeah. But you said just before the 6, oh, the wheels will come off. And guess what happened then?
The wheels came off.
The wheels came off. But anyway,
there's
listen,
potential there, though. That's a good thing.
It's just keeping my head in the game. Right, so the club delighted to host this.
And Dunfanaghy as a club have been very good to the cause last year. And they've come on board again this year. And they give us the course at a very, very reduced fee, which is great because that means that more can go into the charity fund. And as you well know now, as being a member down there, it's a lovely club, great course, it's in great condition. And what we're saying to people today is come and join us. Come and join us on the day. Last year we had 40 teams. This year there's a facility to have actually about 60 teams. I think we're 15 in there already, so it's a great start. The actual day is brilliant. It's great crack. There's great prizes. And as Victor alluded to at the start there, there's an opportunity where the winners of the day will qualify for a great competition in Dublin in, I think it's September time. So the scoring last year, I have to say now, was incredible. So we'll have to practice a wee bit more in advance now.
Now, anyone who plays the game will know that you're getting good value for money here because you are actually supporting a wonderful charitable cause, but it's €200 per team of 4, £50 a skull. That includes your food. There's prizes for the first, second, third and fourth team nearest the pin on a par 3, etc. So in other words, you're getting an awful lot of bang for €50 in green fees or however you want to describe it yourself. And because the club itself is being very accommodating, it means so much of this money goes to support the work and the workers and the facilities at McDonald House. So we just heard there from Claire That's the significance. That's the importance of it. So 50 teams in... how many teams are in at the moment?
Well, we can kid it up to 60.
How many now?
We're 15 already.
15?
Yeah, so right, okay. It's gone. And we haven't really shouted
about
it.
No, it hasn't really kicked off yet. Yeah, wow, okay, that's
most of those from last year, they played last year and they knew about it, so they've got in early.
Yeah.
But there's availability there. But get in early if you can.
What about tea time? So do you contact the club?
Yeah, well, you can go onto the Dunfanaghy website. So it's dunfanaghygolfclub.com. You can phone Victor or you can ring the golf club on 91 36 335, and they'll accommodate you in booking your time slots.
All right, okay. So BizPrint, the printers are on board.
Yep.
The Ronald McDonald House, of course. We at Highland Radio are delighted to be a part of it, and the Value Centre as well. And the main sponsors there are Seamus and the crew at iMotors as well. So all that's left, Victor, at this point is for people to go out and have a blooming good day, play a lovely course, enjoy some beautiful food afterwards, and support the house.
Yeah, and I just want to say as well, a lot of people have sort of started coming around to me now about getting involved. And I want to say a big shout out there to Martin Anderson, Cafe Sander. He obviously doesn't play golf, but he gave me a call. He says, can I hold a coffee morning the day before? So he's hosting a coffee morning on Thursday. And then he raises that day is going into the Classic as well. So I just want a big shout out from 10 to 2 the day before.
Brilliant.
And word got around up in the house. It was such a good day that, as well as Louise, one of the other girls is going to come down and help out in the day as well. So it's just great to see that, like, you know. So.
And I have a bit of good news for Victor as well, because I got a call last night, Greg. I played in the Charity Classic over in London with the Donegal Association, London Donegal Association, and they've actually donated €2,000 from that day to the Ronald McDonald. We also want to thank in advance Martin McHugh.
Yeah.
From and all the Gaelic team down in, where was it again? It was
Kilcar.
They raised over a couple of €1,000 for us.
Brilliant.
As well.
Excellent.
In their golf classic. So people are coming together for a great cause. And what we want to do today now is, you mentioned 8,000 last year. You know, my goal this year is, can we do 16,000? Yeah, I think it's achievable.
Should
I think
be.
It's definitely
should
achievable.
Be, right.
No pressure there, Victor.
No pressure.
A good tailwind. And the reason why, and you heard directly there from Claire, they were able to spend almost 400 nights with Oscar as he battled through his condition, and now he's home and they're forever grateful. Not just the fact that the building is there, but the facilities, the support, and even down to making yourself feel a little bit better with a haircut. And that's what it's all about. So go to dunfanaghygolfclub.com. We have a contact number directly here for Victor Byrne. If anyone wants to sort of say, right, you know what, I'm going to stick a couple of grand in that for you, or I'm going to stick €1,000 in it, whatever it might be, because it's all going to this facility that we hope we'll never need, but all too often families, not least here in Donegal because of our distance from Dublin, often need. Sean Quinn, Gormahagod, thank you very much indeed.
Thanks, Greg.
You went easy on me, in fairness, Sean. Thank you. And also Victor Byrne. Fair play, Victor. Yeah. You know, you don't scream it from the rooftops, but you're doing amazing stuff there.
Absolutely.
Credit where it's due.
Yeah. Thanks, Greg. Thanks for helping.
It's a fixture steeped in history, drama and raw emotion. At Croke Park at the weekend, Kerry and Mayo are going at it. Let's see what Brendan Devaney thinks in terms of who will win. He's, of course, the presenter of the DL debate. I mean, everyone thinks Kerry, but Mayo are going to have to do it eventually, right?
Yeah, Greg, you would hope so. I think only someone with a very hardened heart, or maybe Galway or Roscommon people, would ever deny Mayo a fight, an All-Ireland final victory. Like, it's been so long now, and you know, you think about the 13 All-Ireland finals lost since the last one that they won. But you're just looking at those prior years, maybe even then, as less underdogs, and certainly were very unlucky. They lost four of those finals by a point. They drew two of them. Their current manager, Andy Moran, was actually involved in six of those final defeats. So he certainly knows about the build-up to finals and one in semi-finals, but it's that big one, Greg. And probably people are just looking at maybe the last two games. You know, the Cork game, you know, went okay for me. Oh, the Louth game went brilliantly for them, but Louth faded badly. And Kerry have had two very stern tests from Tyrone and Isley, who could have very easily beaten them. And Dublin really put it up to them. So they've come through, the two of them, Greg. Now they're facing a team that won't go deep defence, will go and attack them all over the pitch, man for man. But I think Kerry will probably revel in that. So it should be a cracking game, Greg. But you just think there's so much experience and know-how. And don't forget, that, you know, it's 20 years since Kerry did like a back-to-back All-Ireland. And I think there's a massive push on from these lads to go get doing that. So it is a huge ask for Mayo to win this match, Greg. Yeah.
But, you know, like, Jim McGuinness has a very clear understanding as what he thinks went wrong for Donegal last year. And I don't think it's about necessarily preparation or quality or ability. I'm just wondering what Mayo might learn. I wonder if they reached out to, has Moran reached out to McGuinness? Because, you know, you could argue we lost that game very early on, and maybe we could see a start to the game where Mayo have learned a little bit about our, you know, shocking and aggressive carry or whatever way you want to look at it.
Yeah, well, I think you're right about the opening of the game anyway, because...
Is that
anything,
it? Is that all I'm right about?
well, there's two parts to that. The first was the start, but technically Mayo play a completely different tactic because they go after teams. They will go after Kerry up the pitch. They will, of course, fall back into a shape and they'll try and get people from the what you call the weak side. So if the attack's coming down the right, they'll drop on a couple of players, try and get people into the left. Kerry will switch it. You know how it goes in the game now. So, but they will go after the ball a lot more. Like Donegal didn't go after the ball at all. They sat in the zonal, and Kerry really came at them with a serious energy. So, but Greg, what I was saying was that opening period, that 15-20 is very important. And do you know what, Greg? I was just thinking about Donegal, and not so much last year's final, but actually the league final. Whenever Donegal really went after Kerry, went after the kick out, and hammered them off the pitch. I think, actually, thinking about it, that Kerry learned a hell of a lot from that, and they had a training camp after that, and they must have worked savage on their kickouts and that, because their kickouts have been brilliant since. And I think they learned a lot from what Donegal did to them in that game, and has made them a much better force, which is a strange outcome from what happened in that match.
Yeah, so there's a head and a heart situation here, really, for the most part, isn't it? The head is probably saying Kerry. But the heart for many, not exclusively, but the heart is Mayo. But it's a one-off game in the Mecca that is Croke Park. It's going to be packed. Anything can happen on the day.
Yeah, and at the minute, Greg, with the new rules now, everything can happen. And we've seen so many times where the favourites maybe haven't lived up to the bill. And certainly, if you look at the energy that Dublin brought the last day, they really got about Kerry. And Kerry have had a lot of injuries, Greg, and I don't think of a lot of boys that you would necessarily call anywhere near 100% of their fitness. They're fit enough on the pitch, but over the course of a game, Dublin definitely had a lot more energy than them, and so did Tyrone. If you look at the energy Mayo have brought in the last couple of games, it has been the best I've seen in the country. So I think there is the plus points, along with the form of Byron, Ryan O'Donoghue and Kobe McDonald. Of course, they're hitting about 85% of their scores, which is brilliant in one way, and it's dangerous in another if they get shut down a bit, and this will be a much more intensive game, certainly than they got against Louth. So there is plus points in there. You can make a case for Mayo. You've just got the savage experience. You know, outside of Dave Cliff, Ganey was very quiet the last day down Ganey. I think he'll revel now in this game.
Okay, who's going to win in your view?
Right. We'll just cut to the chase, will we?
Yeah, just cut to the chase. I've got 20 seconds.
20 seconds. Listen, you have to say Kerry.
Right, okay. I say Mayo. What about you give me 2-1 and it's for the Relay for Life.
You'll
give me 2-1, right?
Yes. No
okay.
Problem, man.
Super stuff. All right. Good luck. I'm going to be paying money. I'm going to be paying 50 quid, which I don't mind. It's for charity. It's to support Danny Limagella's tea day. Have a brilliant one, Brendan.
Cheers,
look after yourself. Greg. Thanks so much as always. He's always good at coming in. That's where we leave it on the program today. The podcast with Mary Coughlin goes live in a couple of minutes. Stay tuned though and listen to John Bresson because his show's fantastic, and you can listen to the podcast then whenever it suits you. Over the next wee while. Back Monday morning at 9 o'clock. Will we be celebrating a Kerry victory or a Galway? A Mayo victory? I don't know. Anthony Joshua's fighting on Saturday night. The darts are on. What else is happening? All right. Anyway, we have to go. We'll see you Monday morning at 9.